Part 4. A Flourishing Fossil Future. Chapter 10. Maximizing Flourishing Through Energy Freedom. A Flourishing Fossil Future. Possible, but not inevitable. The primary purpose of this book is to help you make the crucial life-or-death decisions we face about fossil fuels by giving you what our anti-impact, anti-energy knowledge system doesn't, a full context evaluation of continuing fossil fuel use, both benefits and side effects, from a human flourishing perspective. In part two, we found that, contrary to our knowledge system's portrayal of the benefits of continuing fossil fuel use as trivial and easily replaceable, the ultra-cost-effective energy we get from fossil fuels is fundamental to the unnatural, amazing livability of our world. And not only irreplaceable in the coming decades by alternatives, but needed in growing quantities to make the world more livable for more people. In part three, we found that when we evaluate rising CO2 levels, the only side effect that could hypothetically justify restricting fossil fuel use, without our knowledge system's climate mastery denial and climate impact distortion, rising CO2 is not even demonstrably net negative, and there is no possibility it can negate even just the climate mastery benefits of fossil fuels, let alone all the benefits of fossil fuels. Thus, our full context evaluation of continuing fossil fuel use is this. Fossil fuel use is a fundamental, irreplaceable value to the future of human flourishing that should continue and expand going forward. There should be no limit whatsoever placed on the quantity of fossil fuel use, including no limit whatsoever on CO2 emissions. As I mentioned at the end of the last chapter, this is wonderful news because it means that just as fossil fuel use has made the world an unnaturally livable place for billions of people to date, going forward, expanding fossil fuel use can make it an even more livable place for even more people. Because we have a proper understanding of fossil fuels' masterable and quite possibly beneficial CO2 side effects, we can guiltlessly proceed with using more fossil fuel energy to make the world a better and better place to live for more and more people. Before I address the two big obstacles to this flourishing fossil future, the need for dramatic policy changes and the need to win over a world bent on eliminating fossil fuels, let me highlight a few aspects of a flourishing fossil future that I find particularly motivating, and I hope you do as well. Since I am going to ask you to fight for this future, I want to make clear why this future is so worth fighting for by highlighting four exciting areas of progress that expanding fossil fuel use will drive. Billions of newly empowered people lifting themselves out of poverty. Since 1980, the percentage of humanity living on less than $2 a day has gone from 42% to under 10% today. This wondrous development is the result of increasing and expanding productivity, which is driven by the increasing and expanding use of fossil-fueled machine labor and the enormous amounts of mental labor it frees up. But there is still far more progress to be had. Not only are there the 10% of people who still struggle and die early on less than $2 a day, but the overwhelming majority of humanity still lives at a level that most listeners to this book would consider desperate poverty. For example, 5 billion people still live on less than $10 a day. Expanding fossil fuel use will enable everyone, especially the world's poorest people, to become more productive and prosperous. At the same time, continuing advances in pollution control technology will make it possible for poorer people to use fossil fuels to lift themselves out of poverty with less and less pollution. All of this means more first light bulbs, more first refrigerators, more first rewarding jobs, more first years with a consistently full stomach, more first times drinking consistently clean water, more first years being comfortable, no matter what the weather. Continuing and accelerating progress throughout the world. In Chapter 4, I discussed the virtuous circle of empowerment, whereby our fossil-fueled productive ability drives progress by freeing up time and machine labor for innovation, which increases our fossil-fueled productive ability, which frees up even more time and machine labor for innovation, and so on. It is difficult at any given moment to realize how much the amount of innovation matters in the long term. Every bit of additional innovation increases the rate of progress. And the rate of progress, like an interest rate, compounds. Here's a statistic that drives this home. If the United States economic growth rate of productive progress, had been just 1% lower than it actually was each year starting in 1870, our standard of living today would be lower than Mexico's. Expanding fossil fuel use will drive a faster virtuous circle of empowerment around the world. In the most productive parts of the empowered world, this will mean, among many other values, enormous amounts of time and machine labor spent on medical innovation that can continue increasing our odds of living to old age and feeling better in old age. A faster virtuous circle of empowerment will also mean faster improvements in climate mastery, enabling us to deal with dangerous temperatures, droughts, wildfires, storms, and floods even more effectively. An increasing ability to deal with problems of every kind. Expanding fossil fuel use will give us ample time and ability to address the many challenges ahead of us. Challenges that will undoubtedly be much greater than changing climate conditions. Some of the challenges I am most concerned about are antibiotic-resistant bacteria, growing government deficits, and the rise of dictatorial nations. One great feature of an empowered world is that it has a general and highly adaptive ability to deal with such challenges. We saw this with COVID-19, when the empowered world was able to develop multiple vaccines in less than a year. In fact, the Moderna vaccine was actually designed in a weekend using modern computing machines. A world increasingly empowered by fossil fuels will have the ability to take on the challenges we can think of and the ones we can't think of. For example, overcoming antibiotic-resistant bacteria will depend on scientists empowered by prodigious machine learning capabilities. Overcoming massive deficits will require increasing fossil fuel productivity as well as restraining government spending. And the ability of free countries to protect themselves from dictatorial nations will require using the most cost-effective energy possible to fuel unrivaled productivity and thereby produce world-leading defense capabilities. Continuing evolution and progress in the realm of energy, including alternatives to fossil fuels. Expanding fossil fuel use will also make possible the time and machine labor needed to develop better energy production processes of all kinds, including better fossil fuel processes and, perhaps most excitingly, nuclear processes. For example, one of the most promising emerging technologies is nuclear microreactors that are simple to operate and small enough to fit on the back of a semi-truck. They could be used for everything from powering industrial projects in remote locations to quickly restoring power to areas hit by a natural disaster. One application I find particularly exciting is the creation of nuclear-powered ships that can travel to any coast in the world and provide years of electricity to local populations. And then there is nuclear fusion, the holy grail of energy, which, if it can be commercialized, could make possible an entirely new level of empowerment for human beings. Contrary to the idea that we need to get rid of fossil fuels to bring forward alternatives, we need fossil fuels to free up the time and machine labor necessary to make alternatives competitive and ultimately superior. I hope these possibilities of a flourishing fossil future, rapidly alleviating poverty, accelerating progress, a greater ability to solve problems, and faster energy evolution motivate you to do what you can to fight for a flourishing fossil future? If so, it's crucial to recognize that this fight requires not only trying to persuade a world bent on eliminating fossil fuels not to do so, which I will discuss in the next chapter, it also requires dramatic policy changes, and not just stopping all policies to restrict and eliminate CO2. While eliminating restrictions on CO2 would do an enormous amount of good, far more wide-ranging policy changes are necessary to achieve the full potential of a flourishing fossil future. In particular, we need new and better policies to bring about three key aspects of a flourishing fossil future that current policies are holding back: empowering the unempowered world, fostering alternatives, and handling side effects properly. Empowering the unempowered world. While billions of people today live in an empowered world in which fossil-fueled machine labor produces unprecedented levels of nourishment, protection, and opportunity for fulfillment, billions more do not live in this world. It's crucial to identify what policies are holding these billions back and what changes can lead to global human empowerment. Fostering alternatives. It's crucial to identify how to liberate the use of fossil fuels while also fostering the ability of alternatives like nuclear to substitute where it makes sense today and to develop, if possible, into superior replacements in coming generations. Handling side effects properly. While CO2 emissions should not be limited, there are other side effects of fossil fuel use that clearly should be limited, such as situations in China and elsewhere where governments sanction enormous and largely preventable amounts of air pollution. It's crucial to identify what policies governments should pursue on air, water, and land that rationally limit pollution without depriving citizens of the benefits of energy. In the remainder of this chapter, I will identify the key principles governments around the world should adopt to achieve a flourishing fossil future, along with the specific policy priorities that can make the most positive difference the most quickly. Freedom is fundamental. To identify what types of policies will lead to a flourishing fossil future, a good place to start is to look at the countries that are currently doing the best job of maximizing the benefits of fossil fuels and other forms of energy while handling negative side effects in a rational way, neither ignoring them nor reducing them in a way that does more harm than good. Chief among countries that have done a good job energy-wise is the country I am fortunate to live in, the United States. In much of the United States, we have low-cost, on-demand, versatile energy from fossil fuels, significant amounts of low-cost, reliable electricity from hydro and nuclear, and some of the best air quality in the world. We have also been by far the world's leader in energy innovation, leading the development of everything from the first oil drilling to modern fracking to modern hydropower to lithium-ion batteries to nuclear power plants. What about the U.S. has made its energy policies so conducive to human flourishing and energy progress? Fundamentally, freedom. The freedom to produce energy, properly defined, so as to prevent the improper endangerment of others. The reason why freedom is fundamental is that it liberates the deepest root of productive ability, even deeper than cost-effective machine labor: the reasoning human mind. As I've stressed in this book, we live on a naturally deficient and dangerous planet, and our bodies naturally have very meager productive abilities. To amplify and expand our productive abilities, we need cost-effective energy and machine labor. The more cost-effective, affordable, reliable, versatile, and scalable, the better. Thus, cost-effective energy and machine labor are fundamental to human flourishing. But what leads to cost-effective energy and machine labor? A more fundamental cause: the power of the reasoning mind, which enables us to identify new truths about reality, including truths about how to produce energy and machine labor more cost-effectively. It is the reasoning mind that enables human beings to figure out how to transform heat into motion, the basis of the heat engines that power civilization, how to find oil at low cost, how to build an engine that powers an airplane at low enough cost for the masses to be able to fly, how to burn coal more efficiently and cleanly, how to ensure a reliable supply of natural gas 24/7, 365. We can benefit from energy only to the extent that reasoning human minds can identify cost-effective ways to produce energy, then implement them in reality. And reasoning human minds can identify and implement cost-effective ways to produce and use energy only to the extent they are free to do so. Consider, why has the United States been the overwhelming source of innovation in oil and gas extraction, from the birth of the oil industry in 1859 to the shale revolution that has turned once useless rocks into vast supplies of life-giving, low-cost energy? The reason is freedom. In the above cases, the freedom to own and develop underground minerals. In most countries around the world, the government claims ownership to everything below the surface of the earth, which means that if someone has an idea for a new method of cost-effective oil exploration or drilling, they are not free to implement that idea on their own land or to contract to try it out on someone else's land. Instead, they must get the permission of a government, which historically is not forthcoming for new methods. In the U.S., you are, in principle, free to implement any method you identify for how to cost-effectively explore and drill for oil, so long as you persuade other free people to cooperate, from landowners to investors to employees. And if your idea produces value, you are free to keep and enjoy that value. This kind of freedom maximizes the amount of good ideas that are identified and implemented, just as freedom does in the computer industry, in the medical device industry, and in the mobile phone industry. If we want as many people as possible to benefit from energy, we need everyone to have the freedom to produce energy, which means to identify and implement the most cost-effective ways of producing energy. At the same time, energy freedom, like any freedom, doesn't give us the right to do whatever we want, regardless of our effect on other people. We need policies that define energy freedom so as to prevent improper endangerment of others. In the coming sections, I will lay out the four aspects of energy freedom that governments around the world need to adopt or optimize if we are to achieve a flourishing fossil future for as many people as possible. They are the freedom to trade, the freedom to develop, the freedom to compete, and the freedom from endangerment. Each of these freedoms is severely restricted and opposed around the world due to the widespread acceptance of the anti-impact framework along with other anti-freedom ideas. Each of these freedoms, if understood and expanded, has enormous potential to advance human flourishing. Protect the freedom to trade. A question you might have been wondering about throughout this book is, why is the unempowered world still unempowered? Why are billions of people using so little energy? After all, we know that cost-effective machine labor can dramatically amplify and expand the productive abilities of human beings everywhere. So why isn't it used everywhere? Why is it lacking in much of Africa and in substantial portions of Asia? Of course, these areas are very poor, but recent history has illustrated that it's possible to rapidly empower very poor people through profit-seeking investment from the wealthy, empowered world. When investors invest in factories and industrial farms in unempowered places and in the energy to power them, this can multiply productivity tenfold or a hundredfold and benefit everyone involved. So why isn't this happening everywhere? In large part, because the freedom to trade is not protected everywhere. By the freedom to trade, I mean the freedom to exchange value under a government that enforces and protects contractual agreements. All modern energy production requires enormous amounts of trading among human beings. For example, for a modern electrical grid to function, the grid operator must trade with customers who purchase the electricity, with workers who build and operate the grid, with companies that produce the power plants, with companies that produce fuel, and with owners of the land the operator needs to lay power lines on. Since all of these trades involve long-term commitments, they require contracts between traders that are enforceable, the traders who agree to the contracts have to abide by them, and protected. Outsiders can't interfere with the contractual agreement. If a grid operator cannot engage in long-term trade with customers, if customers can fail to pay without consequence, or outsiders can seize the money customers do pay, it cannot function. The same applies to a grid operator's employees and suppliers. Without long-term contractual trade, the operation cannot function. The freedom to engage in long-term trade using contracts depends on a broader system of property rights and the rule of law. Property rights are the basis of contracts. Under a system of property rights, everyone has a right to their property, including their own labor, a right that includes the right to trade their property via clearly defined contracts, enforced and protected by a government that functions according to the rule of law, not the arbitrary whims of bureaucrats or dictators. To the extent the freedom to trade using enforceable and protected contracts has existed, it has been profitable, cost-effective, for investors to invest in machine labor to amplify and expand the abilities of once manual laborers. For example, the empowerment of billions of people over the last half century has depended on dramatic, though far from ideal, increases in the freedom to trade in places like China and India. The most common form of profitable investment in empowerment is investment in manufacturing. The basic model here is that a company that makes a certain product decides to create manufacturing facilities, consisting, above all, of machines and energy, in a poor part of the world. The company invests in the manufacturing facilities, and sometimes in new supporting energy infrastructure, such as new power plants and power lines, and it pays workers more, often far more, than they were making doing manual labor, usually on farms. The machine labor makes the once manual laborers far more productive than they would otherwise be. This means profit for the business and higher wages for the workers. As productivity and wages go up, once poor individuals can trade for more of any given product or service: food, clothing, shelter, leisure, medical care, education. And as productivity and wages go up, people have more time and other resources to learn more, innovate more, and become still more productive. It's the virtuous circle of empowerment once again. The virtuous circle of empowerment involved in investment in manufacturing is illustrated in a memorable story told by energy and environment expert Michael Schellenberger about a young woman, Supardi, in Indonesia. Before working at a factory, Supardi worked alongside her parents and siblings in the fields. "We were poor relative to the other houses in the community. Our house had 4 rooms and was made of bamboo. We had no electricity or TV. We cooked with rice husks." Supardi moved into the city to pursue opportunities made possible by machine labor. After an initial job at a toy factory, she found employment at a chocolate factory. Her first job was to pour liquid chocolate into moldings and package them. Then she was promoted to deliver chocolate and supplies to other parts of the factory by trolley. And finally, she worked behind a desk, printing product labels, plastic wrap and expiration dates, and barcodes for retailers. Her wages have more than tripled since she first started working in the city. As a factory worker, she was able to purchase a flat-screen TV, a motor scooter, and even a home by the age of 25. Supardi's story is typical of Indonesia and other places around the world. Around the world for hundreds of years, young women have been voting with their feet. They have moved to cities from the countryside, not because the urban areas are utopian, but because they offer many more opportunities for a better life. In the 1960s, Indonesia was as poor as many sub-Saharan African nations are today. It has been able to attract enough manufacturing to drive development. Per capita annual incomes rose from $54 to $3,800 between 1967 and 2017. The wonderful empowerment of Supardi and hundreds of millions of others via foreign manufacturing investment depends on those manufacturers' freedom to trade, including the enforcement and protection of contracts, property rights, and the rule of law. Without the freedom to trade, the rise of hundreds of millions of people like Supardi could not happen. Thus, lack of freedom to trade is the biggest obstacle to empowerment for the billions of people in the unempowered world. I remember talking to an executive at one of the world's largest energy companies and asking him what the key was to empowering Africa. "It's simple," he said. "Foreign investors need to be able to make money on their investments. That means we need to be able to contractually purchase all the different inputs that go into making energy with the confidence that they will not be seized or sabotaged at any moment. And to offer low-cost, reliable electricity, we need to be able to get contractually paid for the electricity we deliver. Because we do not have that confidence in many places," he said, "we won't operate in those places." Until the widespread lack of freedom to trade changes, even if fossil fuels become even lower cost in general, the poorest parts of the world will be only marginally more empowered, because producing energy, including electricity, using fossil fuels, won't be a reliably profitable activity for businesses. Too often, when the issue of empowerment is acknowledged, it is treated as an issue of needed charity. Poor people around the world lack energy, so rich people need to give it to them, building grids and power plants so that poor people can have lights and cell phones and air conditioning. But the key to using significant amounts of energy as a consumer is first using significant amounts of energy as a producer, so that you become productive enough to afford lights, cell phones, and air conditioning, not dependent on receiving them as a gift from abroad. And using significant amounts of energy as a producer depends on the freedom to trade. Thus, policy priority number one to empower the unempowered world is for the unempowered world to create the institutions necessary to protect the freedom to trade: contracts, property rights, rule of law. Unfortunately, the mainstream knowledge system widely opposes the freedom to trade for three reasons. First, its goal of eliminating human impact leads to, at best, a disinterest in, and at worst, a hostility toward empowerment. And the more it is recognized that poorer people will use fossil fuels to empower, the less interest there is in establishing the institutions necessary to empower the poor. Second, widespread opposition to capitalism means that it is hard to make progress in promoting contracts, property rights, and the rule of law, all of which are rightly associated with capitalism. Third, widespread cultural relativism holds that freedom, including contracts, property rights, and the rule of law, is not a universal value, but rather a Western prejudice, that those who have it should not advocate for others. Observe that the world's leading philanthropists, such as Bill Gates, say nothing about freedom in their celebrated efforts to help poor parts of the world. Freedom is so taboo in discussions of poverty that I once gave a speech on freedom called The F Word. As a believer in the universal value of freedom as the political requirement of human thought, human productivity, and human flourishing, I find the view that freedom is only appropriate for some people particularly offensive. And in my experience talking to people from poorer parts of the world, they find the idea that freedom and progress are not for them offensive as well. Until more people are willing to champion freedom, in particular the freedom to trade, in the unempowered world, it will largely and tragically remain unempowered. protect the freedom to develop. A second essential aspect of energy freedom that needs to be drastically expanded to maximize human flourishing going forward is the freedom to develop. To develop is to transform, intelligently impact our surroundings from one form into another on a significant scale. Just as every form of energy production involves trade, every form of energy production involves development. This includes extracting raw materials out of the ground, whether the raw energy itself, such as oil, coal, or gas, or all the materials that go into the energy-producing machines, such as iron, sand, rare earth elements, and oil for producing wind turbines. Building giant energy processing and production facilities, from oil refineries to nuclear power plants. And building long-distance energy transportation infrastructure, from high-voltage transmission lines for electricity to pipelines for oil. Human beings can only engage in cost-effective energy production and therefore modern productivity to the extent they are free to engage in the development that energy production requires. If and to the extent the freedom to develop doesn't exist, energy cannot be produced cost-effectively or at all. For example, when anti-impact activists stopped the construction of natural gas pipelines in the northeastern United States, citizens who could have had low-cost, reliable electricity and residential heating instead have skyrocketing electricity prices and heating shortages. In 2018, this got so bad that New England, near some of the world's best gas fields, had to resort to importing gas by tanker from Russia to keep the lights on. When the freedom to develop exists, the ingenuity of human beings is unleashed to identify and implement the most cost-effective ways to produce energy. All the energy production we have today, oil, coal, gas, nuclear, hydro, geothermal, biomass, solar, wind, required people to be free to engage in massive development. Just as the freedom to trade depends on property rights, the freedom to develop depends on property rights. Property rights allow individuals, including voluntary associations of individuals, such as corporations, to purchase and own resources, including land, and to develop those resources as they judge best, including for productive purposes like energy production, as well as for recreation or the enjoyment of natural beauty. People who outbid others to purchase land tend to be those who can make the most productive use of it, whether making it into an energy-producing development or into a beautiful park that people will pay to enjoy. Thus, property rights make it possible for development to be done where it is most valuable, in the form that is most valuable, by the people who are most capable of doing it. The U.S.'s history of property rights has made it a world leader in innovative development, including the development of innovative ways to get oil and gas. Today's shale revolution, which has made the U.S. the world's leading oil and natural gas producer, was only possible because individuals and companies were free to own underground minerals and thus invest in innovative ways to extract them. How does the freedom to develop apply to government-owned land? First and foremost, it casts massive doubt on how much land governments claim ownership of, such as the 40% of land that the federal government and state governments have taken over in the U.S. Government control of land prevents untold amounts of productivity and enjoyment, including the ability of poorer people to experience the joys of land with more plant and animal life, which, contrary to the mythology that human beings just want to build parking lots, is something almost everyone wants and is willing to pay for. Government control of land also leads to huge problems on that land, such as the wholesale mismanagement of forests that drove the unnecessary damage of recent California wildfires. Indeed, government mismanagement has made the California forests into by far the greatest environmental hazard in the U.S., subjecting millions of people to levels of danger and pollution that a private company or landowner would immediately be shut down for. Insofar as government does own land, the freedom to develop still applies, in that the use of government-owned land should be governed by the human flourishing framework, the implicit framework most people use with their own land, not the anti-impact framework. For example, if a government is tasked with preserving some plot of land that is particularly beautiful, then the government should make that land accessible for people's enjoyment. And the government should allow and encourage industrial development where it doesn't meaningfully compromise human enjoyment. Development of all sorts of minerals should be allowed on public lands, including offshore. This can be done safely and without preventing us from enjoying the oceans or landscapes. The arguable exception for landscapes is solar panels and wind turbines, which are of such low density that they take over landscapes in areas that try to generate a lot of power using solar or wind. The freedom to develop, achieved primarily through the protection of property rights, helps human beings maximize energy production of all kinds, fossil fuels and otherwise. Unfortunately, this freedom is radically restricted around the world by the anti-impact movement. In the 20th century, with the rise of the anti-impact movement, in addition to increasing government control of property in much of the world, property rights became gradually and then completely subordinate to a supposedly higher concern: government's protection of unimpacted nature from human development. Today, anti-property rights, anti-development policies hold back flourishing and progress in every industry. Consider the plight of the modern producer in any industry. Whether they wish to construct a new apartment complex, open a coal mine, site a nuclear power plant, build a new factory, or drill for oil, they cannot count on clear, objective laws to protect their right to develop. Instead, they must deal with open-ended environmental laws and near-omnipotent regulatory agencies that can forbid any project that is regarded as insufficiently green. The producer is virtually guaranteed to face a labyrinth of opposition from environmental bureaucrats, controls, lawsuits, NIMBYs, and activist groups. Every step of the labyrinth costs time and money, and there is no guarantee a project will emerge alive. Vital industrial projects can and have been shut down to preserve the habitats of particular types of rats, frogs, and insects on supposedly private property. Given this industrial climate, it is a wonder that any development occurs in the U.S. and other countries saturated by the anti-impact movement. Ask any leader of an industrial project how much opposition they face in refining the fuel we use to drive, in fracking for the gas that heats our homes, in building the coal or nuclear plants that keep the power on, and you will marvel at the inhuman endurance our industrial producers possess, an endurance we can't and shouldn't have to count on. Anti-development policies have spread throughout the empowered world and the unempowered world. If they can be reversed in favor of the freedom to develop, it would usher in enormous amounts of energy production, productivity, and flourishing. While there are dozens of anti-development policies that need to be reversed, two particularly high-leverage ones are: 1, anti-development incentives to the unempowered world, and 2, anti-impact permitting policies. End all anti-development incentives to the unempowered world. One high-leverage area for protecting the freedom to develop is ending the self-righteous plague known as the sustainable development movement, by which the empowered world spreads anti-impact, anti-development policies in the unempowered world. Sustainable development is a rough synonym for development without impact, a contradiction in terms. Development always involves significant impact. If you are trying to minimize impact, you will minimize development. And in practice, that's exactly what the sustainable development movement does in the realm of energy. This movement has concluded that fossil fuels, nuclear, hydro, and the modern industrial development they make possible, such as industrial agriculture, are unsustainable because they have too much impact on the planet and thus will inevitably cause us to self-destruct. In other words, the delicate nurturer assumption. Advocates of sustainable development can't easily get empowered countries to retrogress and abandon modern machine labor civilization, but they can and do successfully push the unempowered world to stay unempowered by following their anti-human doctrine. For example, the ever-influential Paul Ehrlich and John Holdren in the 1970s opposed plans for spreading industrial agriculture due to their use of fossil fuels. They noted, "Most plans for modernizing agriculture in less developed nations call for introducing energy-intensive practices similar to those used in North America and Western Europe. Greatly increased use of fertilizers and other farm chemicals, tractors and other machinery, irrigation, and supporting transportation networks, all of which require large inputs of fossil fuels." Instead, they advocated much greater use of human labor and relatively less dependence on heavy machinery and manufactured fertilizers and pesticides. That is, an unempowered life. Such a life, they argued, causes far less environmental damage than does energy-intensive Western agriculture. Clearly, they were not talking about the human environment, which is barely livable when farmers engage in manual labor agriculture. The anti-development ideas of the sustainable development movement have been extremely influential. For example, as a result of such ideas, government lending for modern agriculture decreased from 20% of development assistance in 1980 to 3% in 2005. The anti-development sustainable development movement is able to do massive damage to the unempowered world, in large part because of the susceptibility of unempowered countries to pressure from the empowered world. Unempowered countries tend to be A, poor, and B, run by dictatorial governments. Their leaders tend to be extremely eager to get outside money and to impose whatever policies are necessary to get it. The leaders in aid to poor countries are the World Bank and the United Nations, which give or lend money to poor countries for specific kinds of projects and in exchange for certain kinds of behaviors. While in the 1950s through the 1970s, these organizations tended to support development projects using cost-effective forms of energy like hydro and fossil fuels, in recent decades, they have been pressuring poor countries to engage in sustainable development using renewable energy, biomass, solar, and wind. In practice, this means little to no development. We need to stop strangling the unempowered world with sustainable development and instead promote the freedom to develop. One additional danger here for the free world is that when the institutions of the free world refuse to support fossil fuel development projects in the unempowered world, less free countries will often fill the void. China is by far the leader in this area, with its Belt and Road Initiative, which involves building coal plants and other industrial facilities around the world, facilities that will inevitably be subject to Chinese political pressure. End anti-impact permitting policies. Despite the unprecedented technology we have at our disposal for development today, most development is far slower than it was 100 years ago. For example, the Empire State Building took 1 year and 45 days to build in the early 1930s. The reason is that when property rights are respected, producers can develop with astonishing speed. But when they are held back by anti-impact permitting policies, development is glacial. Take the construction of pipelines, a process that is thought to be inherently slow. In the late 1870s, with technology that was incredibly primitive compared with today, a small company led by an entrepreneur named Byron Benson built a 130-mile pipeline through a mountainous area in 3 months. This was possible only because it happened under a government whose job was to protect everyone's property rights. Whether a developer who wanted to build a pipeline or a potential victim of the pipeline's pollution. As evidence of the efficacy of this policy, note that there were some worries at the time that the pipeline would burst, but they were found to be without evidence and thus were not allowed to hold up development. As for the environmental impact on other species, that was up to landowners. Everyone was free to buy property for whatever purpose they chose, whether to run a pipeline, or build a house, or enjoy wildlife, or all three. But no one could dictate what someone else did with their land. Companies with new projects bought up land or acquired land use rights from others, and they could build factories, railroads, oil refineries, and of course, pipelines, to the best of their ability. The result of such a policy was profound. When individuals truly owned and could use their own property, there was no gap between their ideas and their implementation. I call this phenomenon energy at the speed of thought, or more broadly, industry at the speed of thought. In today's American industry, in the 3 months it once took to build a pipeline, it can be difficult to get permission to build a yoga studio. A state-of-the-art industrial project is inconceivable in less than several years. The reason is anti-impact permitting policies. A permit is a permission to develop. Insofar as this phenomenon exists at all, it should be to protect other people and property from genuine demonstrable endangerment. But today's permitting is based on the anti-impact idea that development is wrong. Every development today, even on private property, has to account for its impacts on every species and subspecies in the area, with anti-impact bureaucrats deciding what is too much. If we end anti-impact permitting policies and restore the freedom to develop, we will achieve energy and industry at the speed of thought.